What I want to do this morning is introduce the book of Nehemiah. We have studied for the last couple of months the book of Ezra, and we've looked also at the book of Haggai and Zechariah, who were prophets during the time that is related in the book of Ezra. And so now we want to talk a little bit this morning about Nehemiah, who for a time was a contemporary with Ezra. The book of Nehemiah is a personal narrative. It contains the account of Nehemiah himself and of certain proceedings in which he was engaged during between the 20th year of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and the 32nd year. Well, a little bit beyond the 32nd, maybe 33rd and 34th years as well. It's a natural sequence to the book of Ezra. In fact, it's always been very closely associated with the book of Ezra. The oldest records that we have of the Hebrew canon put them together. In fact, there was a time during which Ezra was referred to as Ezra 1, and Nehemiah was referred to as Ezra 2. And then later they were separated and given the separate names, and then it wasn't until probably about the 4th century A.D. that they came to be separated in the sense that you and I are familiar with them in our English Bibles. So it's a sequence to the history that's begun in the book of Israel. The principal object of the writer of this book, Nehemiah, is to describe the circumstances involved in his being permitted or even commissioned to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And this occurred in the year 444 B.C. I try to give you dates along the way to kind of keep, so that you might kind of stay up to date. We're getting near the end of the Old Testament now, and only the book of Malachi remains sequence. And Malachi was probably written somewhere around 430 to 420 B.C., and then the voice of inspiration ceased for some 400 years, a little more than 400 years, until John the Baptist comes on the scene, about whom we read in the New Testament. And so the book tells about how Nehemiah was commissioned to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls of the city, to reinforce the walls of the temple, around the temple area. And as I said, this occurred in about 444 B.C. To explain his part in these transactions, he begins with a purely personal sketch of himself. And he reveals how it came to be that he was given this opportunity. And this personal sketch takes up the first two chapters of the book of Nehemiah. And then beginning with chapter 3, the main narrative of the book begins, and it continues on through the 5th verse of the 7th chapter, at which time the narrative is interrupted for the introduction of a list which is identical to or nearly identical to the one that we read about in Ezra chapter 2. You remember the list of the names of the families and the numbers associated with each of those families and the names of the heads of those families that returned with Zerubbabel back to Jerusalem. All of that was given in the 2nd chapter of Ezra. And here, for some reason, Nehemiah places that same list, and we'll talk about it again in just a moment. So that's what, and that finishes out the seventh chapter. And then you have in chapters 8, 9, and 10, the narrative is resumed. But interestingly now, whereas up until this, the narrative had been in the first person, it now resumes, but now it's in the third person. And in the chapters 8, 9, and 10, of what the material there deals primarily with religious instruction that is given to the people from the law of Moses. It tells about the celebration of the Feast of the Tabernacles. And also it tells about the voluntary covenant with God, which the people made at the advice and suggestion of the Levites. And then the narrative is interrupted again. And this time, chapter 11 and the first 26 verses of chapter 12 constitutes this interruption. And this interruption consists of six independent lists of the names of people. And we'll talk about those briefly again in just a moment. And then in the last few verses of the 12th chapter, we have the verses 27 through 43. We have the record of the dedication of the wall being completed. And then last, in chapter 13, the record of a number of religious reforms that Nehemiah undertook while he was yet governor there. So that I know you won't remember all that. I guess I should have done a printout and given it to you. But just I wanted to just give you an idea. Chapters 1 through 7 written in the first person. Chapters 8, 9, and 10 written in the third person. There are also some lists. And I never have gone, we don't want to go too deeply into this. You can read on it. But those who are always trying to do away with biblical prophecy and relegate these writings to a much later date so that you can explain it by natural means rather than it being prophecy, they're always looking for things to do, and that occurs here in Ezra as well. And so these lists, for example, one of the lists in the 12th chapter, in verse 12, I believe it is, records the name of a priest who they say did not live until the time of Alexander the Great. And obviously, they say this is evidence of the fact that Ezra was not, this book was not written by, that Nehemiah was not written by Nehemiah in his time, but it was written 100 years or more later. It never occurs to them, apparently, that there might have been another priest by that same name at the time period that's listed here. And one of the things that you may have noticed, I've certainly noticed it, and I don't know whether I pointed it out or not, but in Ezra and also in Nehemiah, as well as throughout the Bible, the frequency of individuals with the same name. That's so very common. There are some 13, as I recall, Zechariahs, for example, mentioned in the Bible. And so it's not at all uncommon for there to have been two priests separated by 100 or more years with a certain name. But anyway, so for that, and without going into it with any more depth, I'm convinced that that Nehemiah, as we read in verse 1, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, I'm convinced that Nehemiah was indeed the author of this book. Now, there may have been parts of it, like these lists, that he more or less authorized. For example, the list that I mentioned in chapter 7, which is all but almost identical to the one found in Ezra chapter 2, is no doubt something that he simply lifted from the historical record and set down. He may not have done it himself, may have had his secretary do that, but It was authorized by him, you can be sure, to appear. And that same thing might very well have been true of some of the list as well. But Nehemiah is indeed the author of the book. The date, we've already made reference to it. Artaxerxes Longimanus, it was his full name, ruled from 465 B.C. until 425 B.C., 40 years. And we've already read about him. This is the same one who permitted Ezra to return that we read about in the 7th chapter of the book of Ezra. Ezra, you remember, was a scribe and a priest, and he returned and with full authority, and we discussed all of that. So he had already been kind to the Jewish people and had shown himself to be interested in what was going on there. By the way, it may very well be, it's not unlikely that these kings were to some degree impressed, or maybe that's not the word I'm looking to, by what they had learned through various ones about the God of heaven, as they often refer to God. Remember Daniel and his position in Babylon? Then there was Zerubbabel and who had no doubt held some position before he was sent back to Jerusalem. And then there was Ezra, who he didn't just pick him out of the blue and send him back. No doubt he knew Ezra, and Ezra had some degree of familiarity with the king and so forth. And so they had some knowledge of this God. But in addition to that, one of the reasons they might have been interested in sending Zerubbabel and Ezra and now Nehemiah to rebuild the walls. And remember now, this is a big thing. It's one thing to rebuild the temple. And you remember we've already seen the opposition that they had against rebuilding the temple and reestablishing themselves in Jerusalem and the surrounding area. But when you start enclosing the area with a wall, that's something else entirely, because then you're raising defenses. And so the people in Samaria, those people who had already been in opposition to it, would now, you better believe. But I started out to say one of the motivations for the king may have been his concern about people like Sanballat that we're going to read about, and some of those other Samaritans. There is some historical evidence for the fact that they had ambitions that maybe concerned the king of Persia. And so establishing in the Jerusalem a city and a people that were under the control of and also somewhat favorable to them would have been a good political move. You understand what I'm saying? So there are all kinds of things going on here behind the background. Okay. So Nehemiah, we're told, is the son of Hakaliah, the tribe of Judah. He was no doubt born in Babylon. He was a child of the captivity. And somehow, we're not given even an inkling of an idea as to how, but somehow through his own merit, his ability, his skills, or maybe it's his the people he knew, maybe he had some relatives who, but somehow or another, he was able to be appointed to this very important position that we'll talk about a little bit later on as cupbearer to the king. You probably have already learned from history, one of the ways they had of the people who wanted to get rid of one king and maybe themselves become king or appoint someone else, they'd poison them. And so the cupbearer and the one who assured him that the king, that his drink was safe, was very, very important to him. And obviously, that'd be somewhat equivalent to the security people that our president has today, whose job it is to keep him safe and protect him and so forth. So he had attained this position somehow or another, and it seems that he was well known to the as you would expect, because Nehemiah would be oftentimes. I don't think he was just one. He was just one of several, no doubt, who were cupbearers to the king, but on occasions. And many times on important occasions, he would be near in the presence of the king and so forth. And so he was known. And I think it's fair to say that he was quite well known. And so we're told in the beginning that Nehemiah was in attendance at the court of Susa. Now, I wanted to, this thing here doesn't have the, I'm told that the red light doesn't show up here for some reason or another. So I've been meaning to bring this to you, to give you an idea of how they made the journey. By the way, you'll recognize, You see the Persian Gulf here, and right above the Persian Gulf, right above the word Elam, you see Susa. That was the capital during this time. It is one of the more ancient cities that's known in all the world. And it's in that very fertile valley just east of the lower part of the Tigris River. And by the way, you see Ur here. That's where Abraham came from. And so really this trek is very similar to the one you remember when Abraham left. And this is very similar, quite similar to the journey that he took. But this is no doubt the journey that Zerubbabel, or very close to the way he would have gone, Ezra, and now Nehemiah, journeying from. The only difference being that some of those left Babylon and he left Susa instead. And he would travel up a little bit west of the Euphrates, up into Tyre and Sidon, and coming down into Palestine. Okay, so. So he's in attendance there, and a brother, and commentators are divided on whether this was his flesh brother, brother of flesh, or just a fellow Jew. But it says his brother Hanani and some others from Judah, we don't know why, but they made the trip from Judah to Susa, and he asked them about the condition of things back home. Now, somehow or another, in his upbringing, someone had left him with a great love for his mother country. He perhaps had never seen it. Perhaps had never even seen Jerusalem. But there was a great love for it, as we're going to see. And so he asked about things there, and their report is not good. They talk about the walls of the city being destroyed and all the difficulties that the people are facing. This doesn't mean that they had recently been destroyed. This is a reference to the destruction that Nebuchadnezzar had caused back when he, in 586 B.C., took Jerusalem and destroyed the city and the temple and everything. The temple had been rebuilt, and some of the people had begun to live in that area, but the walls of the city were still not repaired. And so he was very disturbed about this and began to fast and pray. He first learned about it in the ninth month, and then it wasn't until the first month of the Jewish year that he had a chance again to to be in the presence. I think probably the first chance he had had again. I don't know whether the king had been away at the summer palace or some on some business, and we can't be sure that he had been away, but it kind of sounds to me like that the king had been away and he comes back. And in chapter 2, we read the expression, "When wine was before him," that is the king, "I took up the wine and gave it to the king." Now this expression, "I took up the wine," is interesting. Historians tell us that these cupbearers would, on some occasion, those who were in charge of the food and so forth would bring the wine into the presence of the king, okay, and put it there. All right, and when the king decided he wanted something to drink, whether it was part of a meal or however, the cupbearer would be the one who would get it and bring it to him. And here's how it would be done. He would get one of the containers of it. He would go to the king, and first he would pour some of it in the palm of his hand. And then he would drink that from the palm of his hand and probably wait a minute or some length of time. And if he didn't die, then it would be, he would present it to the king, and the king would. And so that's what this is talking about here. Well, the king notices that he is, he's different from the way he's been. He's not the same Nehemiah. And he inquires about it. What's wrong with you? And he says, well, here's his words. He says, the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, seeing you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart." Then I was very much afraid. And he said to the king, "Let the king live forever." But then he answered his question, Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by the fire?" And so the king said to him, "Then what is it you're requesting?" In other words, I know you're wanting something. What is it you're wanting? And he was a kind of straight to the point type guy, it seems like. And he says, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it." And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "How long will you be gone? When will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me, and when I had given him a time, he said, And I said to the king, "If it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Jerusalem." And so with his permission and with these letters which were given to him, giving him safe passage. Remember now, he's got to go through this territory that is governed by people like Sanballat and Tobiah and others that would not look favorably upon what he planned to do, although he was going to be very careful. Also, he talks about he was given a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest. The commentators are divided on this. A number of commentators think this is a reference to Phoenicia and to Tyre and Sidon, that region where David and Solomon had acquired timber for the first temple, and which Zerubbabel had made an arrangement as well with that country to provide for the rebuilding of the second temple. And so some think that this was a special part, because the word used here is not a word that describes normally just a natural forest, but it's a word that describes more of what we would think of as a park. In fact, the Greek word translates that is a word that comes to be paradise. And so a park, a special place, usually enclosed by a wall or something. And so other commentators believe that it, and also would, we're not talking about building a temple. There would be a need for lumber, but mainly just for the gates. And although, lest I forget to tell you later, there are some 9 to 12, or possibly even 13 gates in the walls of Jerusalem. The commentators are divided on that, but a number of gates. But that's about all that the lumber would be needed for the gates. So a lot of people believe this is some forest that had been built or established closer to Jerusalem, that to which reference is made here. But anyway, he comes back to Jerusalem like Zerubbabel, or rather like Ezra. He waits 3 days after the long journey, I guess, to rest up. He doesn't talk to anybody about why he's here. And on the night of the third day, in the cool of the desert air, let me see if I can go here now. Wait a minute. I am definitely challenged when it comes. Okay. this is, this isn't really what I want either. There we go. Those of you at home, excuse me for turning my back. He leaves by the valley gate over there. You see where it says valley? See the dotted line? That is a rough estimate of his midnight ride. he leaves through the valley gate, and he comes down to the Dragon Springs. Nobody really knows what that was. Some people want to say make it the same as the Pool of Siloam, but I don't think that's the right location for the Pool of Siloam. But something called Dragon. When he comes out that valley gate, he's looking down into the Valley of Hinnom. And the Jews know it as what? Gehenna. And this was the place where all of the refuge from the city of Jerusalem was thrown. It was also the place where generations earlier, some of the kings of Judah offered their children as sacrifices to the Ammonite god Molech. And so this was an infamous area. And he comes out the valley gate, no doubt staying as close to the wall as he possibly can, weaving. He had just a few people with him. He was riding some animal, a donkey or a horse or something. The only beast that they had, apparently the others were walking. And they walk along the wall where they can, and he's observing the wall. He's thinking. He sees the condition, and he's thinking in his mind, planning. He comes down here to the bottom, see the dung gate? He goes by that and then turns up on the east side and goes up to the fountain gate and the king's pool. At about that point there, the rubble becomes, it is so much of it that he can't go any further with his horse. So he has to get down off of his horse, it seems like. And then he goes, the scripture says, he goes by night through the valley. One American Standard Version says by night by the creek, by the brook. And so apparently what he's talking about is the valley that contains the brook, the Kidron Brook. And so this valley over here, where this dotted line is a, you remember when Jesus, after the night of his, before his betrayal, they were in the upper room and they went out of the room through the Kidron Valley up to the Mount of Olives. That's what we're looking at here on this side. So he walks because his animal can't. And he's down in this valley, and it gives him a view of the eastern wall. And I don't know how far. It doesn't tell us how far he went, but he went some distance north. And then after viewing the wall, he turns and goes back and enters again the city by the same gate that he had come out. And he was able to see the condition of the wall, the mess that it was in. I read, Ferris could tell you much more about this, but archaeologists tell us that this area here, before the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, terraces had been built. That's a steep drop off there, and I'm sure Ferris has seen it personally many times, and when they came in there and destroyed that, they destroyed the wall, and it all tumbled down, and those terraces, and all that rubble down at the bottom of that valley was quite a mess. And so that's the condition of it. Now, if we can go back, I wanted you to see, these, of course, are modern pictures of the modern wall, but we need to understand now, this is not just some, like you go up to Tennessee and you see where people have picked up stones and made little rock walls, you know, around their property, maybe knee high. These walls were not like that. And though these are the modern walls, it still gives you some idea of what we're talking about, of what they were before they were destroyed, and of what they were trying to build back. Okay, now here's what I wanted. Now, he gets back the next day, and he goes and talks to the leaders of the city and to the people. He's making plans now to get started on this wall, because he wants to get it built as soon as possible, because he knows there's going to be opposition, and he doesn't want this thing to drag out. And by the way, we'll see when we get into the text that they finish this in 52 days. 52 days. This wall is just under 4 miles in length. And in 52 days, they build it back. Now, it probably wasn't totally torn down in every place. There were places that were worse than others. But this, here's how they were able to do that. When you read chapter 3, and I encourage you to read that, and I know there are a bunch of names that are hard to pronounce, but you've got to see how well planned. He involved everybody, the priests, the Levites, the leaders of the city, even women were involved in building this wall. And everybody was given a little piece of it, some more than others. Some were given only gates, but the gates would be more difficult to build because the buttresses and then the pillars and the gates themselves, these had to be strong to keep the enemy out. And we'll learn later in chapter 13 when he's dealing, they're not keeping the Sabbath. They're conducting business on the Sabbath. And he's going to tell them after they finish the wall, he's put guards at the gates. And he said, I want you to close those gates at the evening and not open them until the morning when the sun is hot. And they were able to do that because they had repaired the walls and repaired the gates to the city. Here's how they did it. Well, you can see that, but you can't see it over here. See the word start up there. He starts at the sheep gate, and he assigns portions. And he names the people that are named would just be the overseers of that particular. Sometimes it's a family, sometimes it's the priest or the Levite, but different ones. Maybe some of them were people whose houses were nearby, and they would be. And some finished their first part, and they would go and do a second part. But I mean, these people were, and we're going to read about the opposition and all, but they started up there at the sheep gate, and he went counterclockwise, assigning different parts of this wall all the way around to be rebuilt, to such that in slightly more than 4 weeks, 52 days, it was finished. Now, it would be some time until he has the dedication. And we'll read about that in the 12th chapter, the latter part of that. But this gives you a little bit of an idea. What strikes me, Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, these were capable people, weren't they? Look at what they did, they accomplished, even though they were still themselves, strictly speaking, captives, servants of another nation. But they were so desirous of rebuilding their homeland, and they thankful even for this. They would never again be a nation. But they were so thankful to be back in their homeland. And remember now, this is all a part. This is not just history. I like history, and it's fun to read it and study it. But this is all part, a piece of the puzzle, if you were, of God's plan for what? Human redemption. Which, as Brother Fenter has told us on Wednesday night many times, has been going on for millennia and would go on for a millennia. God's plan to redeem mankind began really before creation, but it's certainly spoken of early in the Bible, implied in other ways, but in Genesis 3 and 15, as he's been pointing out to us by that prophecy there. God working out his plan for human redemption. And though the nation was destroyed and would never be a nation again in that sense, they were a people, and even through this 400-and-something years where inspiration was silent, he protected them to a degree and kept them so that when John, in the fullness of time, as Paul talks about it, in the fullness of time, that statement is so important within itself. Just one thing. Well, Daniel had seen the great image. It represented four kingdoms. And on the fourth part of that image that he described, that represents the Roman nation. And he said, in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven what? Set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the Roman, the Greek language, was the language pretty much worldwide at that time. And there's never been a language, I don't think, that Carl, I'm getting into water here so deep that I can't swim. But the Greek language itself is a great blessing in helping to spread the gospel, because it's so specific. You can say very clearly what you want to say. And it made it, and not only that, so many people. When I went to Nigeria in 66, just that long ago, English at that time was pretty much thought of as a world language. People in most parts of the world, I'm sure you all met that, but that was certainly true then. So anyway, in the fullness of time, and all of this is a part of that. Have I rambled too much this morning? I just wanted to give you an overview. And beginning, we got 3 weeks now, and you may just want to divide it up in your personal reading and study, X number of chapters, but we'll look at these and finish it beginning next week. Thank you.